loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm John Kiriakou, and I'm joined in studio by co-host Brian Becker. In this hour, we take a look at the news of the day. First, a British court has upheld an arrest warrant for WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange, rejecting arguments that the warrant is moot because Assange is no longer wanted for questioning in Sweden. Next, Senators John McCain, a Republican, and Chris Coons, a Democrat, have come up with a bipartisan immigration bill that they believe will be attractive to both parties. The White House, though, has already rejected it. But will it still be the basis for real immigration reform? Then, the government is set to run out of money again at the end of the week, while Congress scrambles to come up with another continuing resolution. Observers say that the Democrats will not move to shut down the government and instead will seek a standalone bill to address immigration rather than tying it to the budget. And then, the Trump administration is continuing its internal deliberations over what it euphemistically calls a bloody nose policy for North Korea. In fact, it's a policy to attack North Korea militarily. At the same time, Victor Cha, a Bush administration official and Georgetown University professor whom Trump had named as ambassador to South Korea, had his nomination withdrawn after saying that the policy was a bad idea. Meanwhile, a group of Democratic senators have published an open letter saying that the president does not have congressional authority to launch any strike on North Korea. And finally, Secretary of State Rex Tillerson has signaled his support for a coup in Venezuela, praising the history of military rule in Latin America and calling the armed forces an agent of change. That's all starting next on Loud and Clear. But first, we turn to Julian Assange. A British court has upheld an arrest warrant for WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange, rejecting arguments that the warrant is moot because Assange is no longer wanted for questioning in Sweden. We're joined from New York by Randy Credico. He's an activist, a comedian, and the former director of the William Moses Kunstler Fund for Racial Justice. He's going to help us figure this out. Randy, welcome back to the show.
Hey, it's great to be back. Thank you, John and Brian.
We're always glad to have you. Randy, this really doesn't seem to make logical sense. If there's no criminal indictment hanging over Julian Assange in Sweden, why in the world would the British not dismiss the arrest warrant and just expel him?
Well, first of all, what happened today in that courtroom was on point one, just the first point she rejected, and that is Article 7 of the Constitution on this matter. But she has reserved the three other points that were raised by his defense attorneys. Jen Robinson specifically came out today and said that that has been reserved judgment on those three points until next Tuesday, the 13th. So this is not over yet. In fact, my friend in the Ecuador embassy yesterday told me that this is just the beginning before it even started today, that whatever happens today will go forward. Now, what happened today is you have to understand, you know what the criminal justice system is like in the U.S.
Oh, yes.
Well, it's no different there. And the influence of the U.S. government over what goes on in the British courts is really exponential. And so what you have is a judge under pressure. Now, this was a judge in a municipal courtroom, and the question here was an attached warrant based on a European arrest warrant by the Swedes, which they dropped. They dropped the never charges, this allegation. So they've been holding him on this, based on this EAW, for the last 7 years. So they have found ways to get around the law here. And so the judges, basically, there's a lot of pressure on them. The U.S. has so much influence on the way they do business there. I mean, he has cleared every hurdle only to be rebuffed by a perverted way of interpreting the British legal system.
That's the voice of Randy Credico. He's a political activist and a journalist. He's a comedian. We're talking about the court ruling in Britain today regarding Julian Assange, a bad ruling, a ruling without conscience, and I think a ruling without law, a ruling that defies international law. We have the British court. We also have, of course, the United Nations. And the United Nations, John, as you remember, 2 years ago, a UN panel decided that Julian Assange's, at that time, 3.5-year-long detention or stay in the Ecuadorian embassy amounted to arbitrary detention.
That's right.
Which meant that he should be freed. In other words, he was being wrongly imprisoned, arbitrary detention. That was 2 years ago. So we have the British court, we have the United Nations, which has ruled for Julian Assange. Then we have the Court of World Public Opinion. And I think perhaps that ultimately will be the most important court. And that court, I think, decisively is on the side of Julian Assange because he's a truth teller. And he told the truth about people who are real criminals and people who have engaged in real criminal conduct like the war of Iraq and the killing of civilians and torture. And then there's another court, and that's the U.S. court. And there's a U.S. grand jury, perhaps, that's been secretly impaneled that's designed to carry out what will be ultimately a death sentence for Julian Assange if they can get their hands on him. And again, all for what reason? Because WikiLeaks as a media outlet has told the truth
yes.
about the criminal conduct of the U.S. government, the British government, and other governments. That's why Julian Assange has been targeted.
Oh, absolutely. Julian Assange and WikiLeaks embarrassed the American government. They embarrassed George W. Bush, and they embarrassed Barack Obama and the state, you know, and this isn't specific to a party, but the state will not allow that to happen. I'm looking at an article in The Telegraph, the British newspaper, The Telegraph, Randy, and it says that Julian's lawyers pointed out in the court today that UK authorities refused to confirm or deny whether a U.S. extradition warrant has been received. Have you heard anything about a U.S. extradition warrant?
Well, you don't really know if there is one or isn't one. Either way, it works in the U.S. government's favor. Either they're going to extradite him, they have a warrant, or they don't, and they're bluffing, which keeps him kind of immobilized in that embassy there and not able to get around and do what he does best, which is journalism. So they got him scared, got him kind of, you know, neutralized somewhat. I don't know if there really is one. The UK government won't say, the US government won't say, except for you have declarations by CIA Director Pompeo that WikiLeaks is an kind of a foreign, hostile intelligence entity, and you have Jeff Sessions saying that it's a high priority. Now, whether they have one or not, I do not know, but it certainly is something that he should be fearful of, because to come to this country, as yesterday, Lori Love, there was the chief judge in that case that decided not to allow him to be extradited to the U.S., citing prison conditions in this country, how brutal they are and how rancid they are and unhealthy and violent. So he would not, this judge, allow the U.S. to extradite Lori Love yesterday, which I thought was a harbinger of good news today that this judge, now this is a municipal judge, by the way, this is not a high court judge.
Sure.
And as Julian said, this was the beginning, no matter what. If they had won today, it was going to be appealed by the Crown Prosecutor Services. And if they lost today, the same thing would have been appealed by his brilliant lawyers. He has the most brilliant lawyers in the world. So this is just being postponed for 1 week. We'll see what happens the following Tuesday. In the meantime, it's great that we get a fair assessment out of this from your station, because you're certainly not going to get this from the mainstream media. Unfortunately, what they have is CNN is basically now a repository for ex-high-level CIA officials like Brennan and Clapper. And if you're going to get their point of view, it's going to be negative on Julian Assange, this guy, Phil Mudd. That's what you have there. So it's good that you're able to get the information out. You're right. Public opinion worldwide is on Julian's in Julian's favor. And I think that is what is needed to kind of extricate him out of the dire situation that he's in and not depend on the U.S. criminal justice system or the British criminal justice system, because as Craig Murray said, that the whole thing is a charade. He tweeted out something very good, that this judge basically has to do carry the water of the state, and the state is the MI6, the MI5, BP, EA. What is it? The EA, that military firm there, BAE. These are the controlling interests. They don't want Julian Assange to continue disseminating information that is truthful. Just like they're going after your network here, or going after RT here, they're going after anyone that says anything contrary to the imperialistic narrative that is really, what undergirds this entire operation.
That's Randy Credico. We're talking about the British court ruling that upheld the arrest warrant for Julian Assange, a terrible miscarriage of justice. I'm looking at, on Twitter, Julian Assange tweeted or retweeted a meme, which I think is an important meme for people to see, you at Julian Assange on Twitter. It's a picture of Jeff Sessions. Under it, the words, Assange's arrest is a priority. Picture of James Comey. Under it, Assange hasn't been apprehended because he's in the Ecuadorian embassy in London. And then you have Mike Pompeo, the director of the CIA, and under his picture, Assange has no First Amendment rights. The CIA is working to take down WikiLeaks. Here you have Julian Assange, who did what? He provided to the media, and all the media has treated WikiLeaks as a source.
Sure.
The New York Times, the Washington Post, you name every corporate-owned establishment media, they're glad to use WikiLeaks as a news source because it's told a different story, actually the true story about what's going on. And none of these corporate-owned media are willing to stand up. Their much-vaunted defense of freedom of speech and freedom of the press, they're not doing a thing for Julian Assange right now because in the face of power, in the face of Jeff Sessions or James Comey or Mike Pompeo or many, many other hardline hawks, both in the Congress and in the executive branch of the government, the corporate-owned media are nothing but sheep. And that's actually why
right.
we need WikiLeaks.
Sheep or shift, either way.
And
you
that's why we need WikiLeaks.
That's right.
That's exactly why Julian Assange should be free. And that's why WikiLeaks needs to publish. John Kiriakou, I think we're out of time.
Yeah, we are out of time, unfortunately. We were joined from New York by Randy Credico. Randy is an activist, a comedian, and the former director of the William Moses Kunstler Fund for Racial Justice. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Please stay tuned. We'll be right back after this.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Senators John McCain, a Republican, and Chris Coons, a Democrat, have come up with a bipartisan immigration bill that they believe will be attractive to both parties. The White House, though, already has rejected it. But will it still be the basis for real immigration reform? We're joined from Los Angeles by immigration attorney Alan Diamante. Alan, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you. It's a pleasure.
Alan, we're looking at press reports about this proposed bill, and it seems to have elements of what both parties want. There's money for Donald Trump's wall, or at least $25 billion, to fortify the border. It would allow a path to citizenship for Dreamers, or at least a path to permanent legal status. And it would allow what the Republicans are calling chain migration, what everybody else calls family reconciliation or family reunification. So why would the White House be opposed to something like this?
Okay. Well, this is my understanding of what it is. I know that the White House has already mentioned its four pillars, that they want money for a wall. The president asked for $25,000. I think his advisors are requesting $30 billion versus $25 billion. And also they want to get rid of family immigration, which they coined as chain migration. This is family immigration. I'll tell you right now, if a U.S. citizen wants to immigrate an adult son from Mexico, that person would have to wait over 20 years, a whole generation. So if your son turned 21 while your younger children were able to immigrate, but your son turned 21, that person today is waiting over 20 years to immigrate. They want to get rid of it altogether. They do not believe in family unification. I have a big concern with that. With the building of the wall, the thing about the McCain and Coons bill, and then you also got in the House heard an Aguilar bill, which is very similar. It's about giving a pathway to citizenship to the people that have DACA, the Dreamers, and the ones that even didn't apply but were eligible. So we're talking about it could be 1.8 million people. Well, we got Donald Trump saying, oh, I offered that, but I just want all those other things with it. And now he's talking about that it's a non-starter, this McCain-Coons bill and the Hurd-Aguilar bill. These are non-starters. You also have Paul Ryan, the Speaker of the House, who says that he's in line with the president, and he wouldn't even put the Hurd-Aguilar bill for debate because he believes that is not the appropriate bill to have on debate, that he believes that that Donald Trump was very sincere when he offered a path to citizenship to the 1.8 million, as long as he had $25 billion. I think it's shameful. Very shameful. We're talking about, see, what I do every day is I see these dreamers. They come to my office. They're living with high anxiety every day, not knowing if they're going to be deported. They were raised in this country. They went to school in this country. They have their friends in this country. They have their family in this country. And now they're living with the fear that not only are they going to lose their jobs, but they're going to be uprooted for what they know as home and being separated from their family and friends. And most of them are going to go, if they leave, they're going to have to go back to a country that they really don't understand the culture. They really don't know the people. A lot of them lost contacts. They're living in high anxiety. In my opinion, what the president is doing with his negotiation game is he's playing with the lives of all these folks, and it lacks any empathy and any concern, any humanitarian concern. And it's shameful. Now, with respect to the wall, you know, I agree with McCain and Coons and with Hurd-Aguilar. Let's invest a little bit of money, you know, some money for purposes of analyzing this, determining whether or not we need a wall. We might need more security. And I think everybody here that's making these proposals, I'm talking about people in the House, which the Hurd-Aguilar bill is a bipartisan bill with 27, I believe, co-sponsors at this time. I mean, they might have more in both parties.
27 Republicans and 27 Democrats. Truly a bipartisan bill. This is Hurd-Aguilar.
Exactly. And then you got McCain and Coons that, you know, they have support as well. And you know, what they're suggesting in their bill is very similar to Hurd-Aguilar, and I think it's a good start for negotiation. Now, the president at one point said, "Oh, I love Dreamers," but this is the way he shows his love. It makes no sense. I think his four pillars is a non-starter, and the fact that he's just asking for $25 billion to build a wall, why doesn't he request let's say $25 trillion to build a ladder to the moon? Would that be a good idea? I mean, he's just throwing these figures out of the wind. And, you know, I'm very passionate about this because, again, I see these people every day. They are human beings, and they deserve the same respect as anybody else in this country, whether they were born here or not. And it makes no sense that he would play with their lives the way he's doing. And if he's being serious, why not invest some money, allow the House and the Senate to invest some money in analyzing the security issue to make a determination what's actually needed. And do we really need a wall? No. We might need some, you know, further security in different parts of the wall. And if you look at Representative Hurd, his district is actually on the border.
It is.
He understands it. He gets it. So, again, my position is, as the president saying that these bills are non-starters, basically what he's been doing is a non-starter. It's disingenuous, and it's, you know, I can't think of, I could think of many extreme words I want to use, but I don't think it would be appropriate on your program.
Yeah, we hear you. We hear you loud and clear, actually, in that. Ellen, you know, there's people came to the United States, the people who are here now, they came because their families, earlier families came, and they came really from one of three channels. You either were an indigenous Native American person, you came because your family was kidnapped and you were enslaved from Africa. And the third group of people in America, it seems to me, are people who came because their family members came and brought other family members. That's how my family came.
My entire family came
from both
way.
Sides.
Yeah, from both sides.
And that's how John Kelly's family came. That's how everybody's family came,
sure.
Unless you were a native indigenous person or an enslaved person from Africa. So now you have the language chain migration, which sort of demonizes, not sort of, it completely demonizes people who come with their families, something that all of the demonizers forget to mention. That's how their families came. I mean, that shows the utter absurdity of it, but ultimately, it's racism. Ultimately, it's white supremacy. It's really about black and brown immigrants who are coming. That's what they're really talking about. It's this toxic mix of racism. And Alan, I'm wondering if what's stopping immigration reform at this point is just a pandering to a white supremacist sort of sentiment in some part of the population, which I would have to say has also been stimulated by Trump and by those who are, quote, pandering. They're not just pandering. They're catalyzing this kind of political sort of, I don't know what you would call it, nativism maybe. A semi-fascism, I would say, also. Anyway, your take on that.
Well, I can't disagree with you in any way of what you just said. Again, as an immigration lawyer, I have clients from all over the world. And just somebody who appreciates history so we don't repeat history, and I'm very concerned about the fact that and during this time under the Trump regime, we're threatening to repeat history. There's this massive persecution of people that are coming into the country trying to escape persecution. We have people migrating, let's say, from El Salvador and Guatemala, and some of them are escaping from poverty, but a lot of them are actually escaping from violence. And the way we mistreat these people when they come to the United States seeking asylum, we violate our own regulations, we violate our own statute, we violate the Constitution, and I do agree. It's a minority in this country that has put the president in the White House. A minority is what he has is a base, and he's pandering to that base. And the word I could use, and I'm going to use it over and over again when I describe this president, is shameful. He's been dishonest with us. He's misrepresented to the American people on multiple occasions. And yes, we got people that came from Africa. They were kidnapped and brought here, and they were put into chains. So the fact that they even use the term chain migration, I must use
good
the word
point.
Shameful.
Good point.
Yeah. And then you have the indigenous folks. A lot of the people that are migrating from Central America have been displaced, and a lot of them are indigenous, and they're displaced. And we could talk about the history of what we've done to the indigenous in the United States. Which is also a shameful part of our history. We don't want to repeat that. And, you know, some people just can't control what they say in government. And we do know that a lot of folks that are in Congress, a lot of folks that are in the Republican Party, a lot of folks that come from, that are representatives in the southern states, you know, they come from a lineage of folks that have been racist. You know, they were obviously racist in the 50s. They probably became a little bit more covert about it since the 60s and the 70s and the 80s. And now they're feeling comfortable in being racist again. And it's unfortunate that you got to ask yourself, how many generations does it take for a culture to transcend beyond racism? And in my opinion, this is a time that the American people must look at themselves in the mirror and ask themselves, have they transcended? Are they better than they were 100 years ago or 150 years ago? And I think there's a percentage of our population, which is clear, given the fact of who we have in the White House, that haven't transcended whatsoever.
Yeah, we're coming to a breaking point, it seems, rather quickly. We'll have to leave it there. We were joined from Los Angeles by immigration attorney Alan Diamante. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay tuned, and we will be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
The government is set to run out of money again at the end of the week while Congress scrambles to come up with another continuing resolution. Observers say that the Democrats will not move to shut down the government and instead will seek a standalone bill to address immigration rather than tying it to the budget. We're joined from Washington by Dr. Wilmer Leon. He is a political scientist and author, and he's the host of a nationally broadcast talk radio show on Sirius XM Channel 126. Dr. Leon, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you, John, and good morning, Brian.
Thank you.
We're glad to have you. So what do we make of this continuing resolution? You know, Brian and I were talking just before the show started, and we think, I'm not positive, I'm going to research it, but we think that the last time Congress passed a budget in time for the start of the fiscal year was during the Clinton administration. So is this now going to be the norm that we're going to fight over continuing resolutions that last a week or 2 weeks? Or is Congress ever going to get serious and pass a budget?
That's a great question, and unfortunately, my crystal ball is in the shop. So let me tell you that, you know, things don't seem to be getting any better. That they're, both sides seem to be focused more on being entrenched in their own positions and being focused on placating their very narrow constituencies than operating in the best interest of the American people. And let me give you one quick example. We're coming up on Thursday night. Midnight is when this deal is supposed to be done, or the government shuts down on Friday. But earlier in the week, where were the Republicans? They were at the Greenbrier Resort in West Virginia. And where are the Democrats going to be in another day or two? They're going to be in the Cambridge Resort in Cambridge, Maryland. So it seems as though they rather go to their respective corners and huddle and talk within their echo chambers than actually hammer out a deal that works for the best interest of the American people.
Brian, that's true. That's true. If they really wanted to get this done, they would stay in Washington and get it done.
The issue right now, there's several issues. The Democratic Party allowed the government to be shut down for a very brief time earlier, a couple of weeks ago, over the fact that there was no relief in the continuing resolution or the budget for the Dreamers. That's 800,000 to a million young people who came here as children, young children, and have been here, many of them, for decades. They came as part of an undocumented family, but their entire lives they've lived here in the United States. They go to school here. They work here. President Obama passed DACA, the Deferred Action on Childhood Arrivals. He tried to help their parents as well. He shielded them, actually, from deportation. Donald Trump came in and signed an executive order rescinding any relief or shield for DACA. And the Democrats tried to get something in the bill for DACA. Now, most people in the United States, including most Republicans, are sympathetic to the Dreamers, the DACA recipients.
Yes.
But it was clear that Trump was able to use the government shutdown to carry out what was, in essence, a demagogic appeal against the Democrats and say, see, the Democrats only care about immigrants. They only care about the undocumented. They're willing to shut the government down and not let our soldiers and sailors and Marines be paid just because they care more about immigrants than about the people serving in America's armed forces. I mean, it was a straight out demagogic appeal, but it worked. And the Democrats caved after a few days. So now the Democrats are saying, well, we're going to have a separate bill on DACA, a clean bill. It'll either pass or it won't pass. Mitch McConnell says he's going to let it come to the floor of the Senate. The House is much more right wing in terms of the so-called Freedom Caucus against any kind of immigration reform or any kind of immigration relief. So they don't want to be held responsible once again for a government shutdown. So they're separating that. Now, I don't know how the Dreamers feel about that. But I think they're feeling pretty betrayed by all sides.
They must be.
They have to be. And a lot of the, you know, we're talking about 1 million to 2 million families whose lives are about to possibly be terribly ripped apart if they start to be deported. I mean, that's what's happening. But Dr. Leon, what are then the issues that would stop this continuing resolution from being passed if the Democrats have removed DACA or the Dreamers from consideration?
that's a legislative tactic that the Democrats are trying to implement. And if they can, in fact, get that done, then I think you'd see things move forward. The question, though, is I think the Democrats are also looking for on this military spending bill. They're also looking for, if the military is going to be funded, then they want the social programs funded as well. So I don't know that it's just as simple as if you give me A, I give you B, and we can get this whole thing done. Because, you know, within the Republic, on the Republican side, you've got some fairly reasonable individuals, and you've also got some ultimate conservatives that it seems to be it's their way or the highway. And then on the Democratic side, you seem to have some similar divergent constituencies. So we're going to have to see, A, who can actually dig in and create a case that and make an appeal to the American people. The Democrats are terrible at doing that. And versus President Trump, who is very good at playing the media, and the Republicans, who are very good at creating message, understanding messaging, and staying on message.
You know, one of the things, John, that seems to me is that the Democrats and the Republicans are 100% united behind the military budget. Now, Donald Trump submitted a military budget, a defense spending budget of about $700 billion. The Democrats and the Republicans upped it by $40
billion. They did.
They joined together in imposing new sanctions on Russia, additional sanctions on Russia, Iran, and North Korea. That was bipartisan. So in many ways, for the Republicans to make the case that the Democrats are weak on defense is just nonsense. If anything, the Democrats who are now saying, well, we want social program spending as well, not simply rubber stamping another bloated military budget, it seems to me that that's kind of also demagogic for the base of the Democratic Party, mainly working class and poor communities who rely on many of these services. The Democrats aren't really going to fight for them. And the fact of the matter is, maybe you can't have guns and butter. In other words, you can't spend this much money on the war machine and then at the same time say, oh, yeah, but we want to equally fund housing and education and healthcare and social programs that benefit poor people. So there's the horns of a dilemma. The Democrats are escaping really public scrutiny on it because the Republicans are even worse when it comes to this. It seems to me when you look at the big picture here, we have a government, a Congress, one of the three branches of government, whose main function is every 3 or 4 weeks to pass a bill to keep the government funding. In other words, it's a government a Congress that does nothing. Go ahead, Dr. Leon.
Well, I think there's an awful lot of validity to what you're saying, but what we also have to factor into that equation is the debt ceiling and the spending caps. You know, there was a time in this country when we did have guns and butter, but that was a time also when the defense budget wasn't incredibly bloated and taking an incredible chunk out of money available to spend in this country. And then you compound that with, and again, the debt ceiling and the problems with the debt ceiling that are being exacerbated by Trump's ridiculous tax cuts. So it's almost as though the Republicans keep saying, you know, don't drive the car in the ditch. But we have to say to them, we'll take your foot off the accelerator and try to brake once or twice, and that might stop the car from going in the ditch.
Yeah, and that's maybe the other elephant in the room. I mean, the Congress, the Republicans, just passed a tax plan that gives $1.4 trillion in tax breaks to the ultra-rich and to the corporations. That's money that won't be there in the national treasury, and then they can make the case, well, we just don't have the money for social programs.
Yeah,
which was the whole objective behind passing those tax cuts in the first place.
Yes, yeah, it was to spur growth. And you know, we have to wrap it up, but I want to say that I did do some quick research and found that the last time Congress passed a budget, in time for the start of the fiscal year was 1997. In the last 40 years, they've done it only four times.
That's just 21 years, John.
I'm sorry that we have to wrap it up. We were joined from Washington by Dr. Wilmer Leon. He is a political scientist and author, and he's also the host of a very interesting nationally broadcast talk radio show on Sirius XM Channel 126. It's on Saturdays. Stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back after this.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
The Trump administration is continuing its internal deliberations over what it euphemistically calls a bloody nose policy for North Korea. In fact, that's a policy to attack North Korea militarily. At the same time, Victor Cha, a Bush administration official and Georgetown University professor whom Trump had named ambassador to South Korea, had his nomination withdrawn after saying that the bloody nose policy was a bad idea. We're joined from Toronto by Chris Black. He is an international criminal lawyer who is on the list of counsel before the International Criminal Court. Chris, welcome back to the show.
Thanks. It's good to be here.
Chris, it just seems that U.S. policy toward the Koreas right now is in disarray. We can't find an ambassador to fill the position. And indeed, this is the longest stretch that we've not had a U.S. ambassador in Seoul since the Second World War. What do you make of this? Are people inside the administration just not yet decided, or is it something more sinister?
I would suspect it's something more sinister, in that I wouldn't want to be an ambassador situated in Seoul if an attack is going to take place very quickly or imminently. So it may be internal politics. They can't find anybody suitable for that particular position due to policy disputes and so on. But the whole scenario has me worried that something else is going on and developing quite rapidly, that an attack may take place. And that's why they place no one there.
Victor Cha, the person who's a Korea expert in the U.S. government, he was supposed to be nominated, and his nomination has been withdrawn. That came after he openly spoke against a preventive military strike. He wrote such a strike could spiral, quote, into a war that would likely kill tens, if not hundreds of thousands of Americans.
Right.
You know, and let's look at who Victor Cha is, too. He is a down-the-road conservative Republican. He served in the George W. Bush White House. There's nothing left or liberal about this guy at all. But even he can't abide by the Trump Korea policy.
John, you're not getting it. You're just not understanding. He is a liberal because he's trying to avoid hundreds of thousands of Americans getting killed in the war. I mean,
he's human rights crazies.
bleeding heart hippie. Victor Cha's a hippie.
We also have to remember that the North Koreans admire very much President Jimmy Carter, because they told me that when I was there in 2003, that Jimmy Carter came over, well, I think 2001, when there was trouble between North Korea and the Clinton government at that time. And he told them that some faction in the Clinton government was intending to attack Korea, and that he came over to have a press conference and solve that and deflect that. So there were two factions within the United States government, one that wanted to have an aggressive policy and attack, and one which feared such a thing. And Jimmy Carter represented them. So there are faction fights going on inside. So maybe it's a reflection of that. But why they haven't chosen somebody else to replace him as ambassador is a question.
I want to read a few words from the New York Times. The White House has grown frustrated in recent weeks by what it considers the Pentagon's reluctance to provide President Trump with options for a military strike against North Korea, according to officials. The latest sign of a deepening split in the administration over how to confront the nuclear-armed regime of Kim Jong-un. The National Security Advisor, Lieutenant General H.R. McMaster, believes that for Mr. Trump's warnings to North Korea to be credible, the United States must have well-developed military plans. But the Pentagon, they say, is worried that the White House is moving too hastily towards military action on the Korean Peninsula that could escalate catastrophically, giving the president too many options. Hear this. Giving the president too many options, the official said, could increase the odds that he will act. So what the New York Times is suggesting is that not only is there a debate, but the Pentagon, under the leadership of James Mattis, doesn't actually want to provide to the request made by the White House for military options, because if they give them those kind of contingency plans, someone or people within the White House will actually act on them. I mean, if that's true, which this is the New York Times, this is not like a left-wing newspaper talking about that. If that's true, that shows that there's a heightened sense of division in the administration, and it also shows that the Pentagon believes that there are some people who really want to have a war with North Korea. I mean, there's no other way to read this particular article, I don't think.
Right.
Right, and we have to include in this the recently released Nuclear Policy Review, which is very aggressive, and as Jan Oberg of the Transnational Peace Foundation says, it's a very dangerous document because it lowers the threshold for the use of nuclear weapons and makes them almost a conventional weapon that the commanders can use them on the battlefield, even in a non-nuclear attack, even conventional war scenarios. And North Korea and terrorism is included in that. And they accuse North Korea of, if they think that North Korea is giving nuclear material to some terrorist group, they'll attack them, which means they can attack them for almost any pretext. So there does seem to be a faction fight going on. The New York Times representing one faction and other people representing the other faction. Yeah. I hope that the New York Times faction wins out, because otherwise it will be a catastrophe for the entire world.
Yeah, in the Nuclear Posture Review, John, which we talked about with experts, Greg Mello and Kevin Camps a couple of days ago, that Nuclear Posture Review includes cyber warfare as a pretext for the launch of a nuclear attack. In other words, if the United States is attacked by cyber weapons, online weapons, that right. alone is a pretext to use nuclear weapons, according to this new official right. nuclear policy by the White House.
And you can make an accusation of a cyber attack anytime you want. I mean, there are hackers out there hacking from their parents' basements that you can just as easily blame on North Korea or Iran or Russia, China, whatever you want. Whomever
true.
You want to blame, it's easy to blame somebody.
Yeah,
and you can even create false flag attacks and say it was
exactly.
as a pretext. Yeah.
There was the hack of Sony, and after Sony Pictures, the Japanese-owned film company, released the movie The Interview, which had in one of the scenes the assassination of Kim Jong-un, then Sony was hacked and all of the data for tens of thousands of people was taken. The U.S. government, the Obama administration, immediately asserted that was North Korea. That was retaliation for Sony making the movie. But then later, a lot of technology experts said, well, actually, it doesn't look like that. It looks like it could, in fact, be an inside job. There was a disgruntled employees. But in the meantime, if you have a Nuclear Posture Review saying a cyber attack is the basis for a nuclear attack, and some government agencies say we have a high degree of confidence that it was, in fact, the DPRK, and then that high degree of confidence dissipates later, and it's like, maybe, maybe not, could be a hack, could be a leak, we don't know, we don't really know who did it. The CIA has the Vault 7 tools where they can, you know, hack into websites email servers and leave false signatures, false flag attacks. In other words, they can use another signature to make it look like somebody else did it, make it look like North Korea did it or China or Russia. They have those tools now. We know them because they've been leaked. They've been hacked themselves. But in the meantime, we could have a war. In other words, between the time where there was a high degree of confidence that it was North Korea that carried out a cyber attack and the later sort of skepticism about that report, in the meantime, according to the Nuclear Posture Review, an offensive military strike could be carried out with nuclear weapons, which would then, of course, invite retaliation from North Korea. I mean, that's how reckless this is.
And if we have an administration that says publicly that it believes that Kim Jong-un is irrational, then it stands to reason that you would expect him to react irrationally. So maybe the better policy is to not provoke him in the first place.
Yeah, that just makes sense. But
right, and we remind the listeners that North Korea all along and continues to just ask for two simple documents, a statement that they will not be attacked by the United States, and a peace agreement. And then they would be willing to get rid of the nuclear weapons, but they fear, since the United States refuses to give those documents, at least a declaration of non-aggression, they believe they are going to be attacked, so they defend themselves. And so it's a self-fulfilling prophecy, and I think that the nuclear weapons in North Korea are just a pretext, because a lot of countries have nuclear weapons. So what? North Korea is not attacking anybody, doesn't want to attack anybody. I think it's just a pretext for the American government to show the world that they dominate the world completely, and anybody that stands up to them has to be whacked, basically.
Yeah, it is a very useful pretext. We know the Obama administration in Australia in 2011 announced the so-called Asia Pivot, and what that means is that by 2020, 60% of the U.S. naval and Air Force assets will be in the Pacific region. All of that is not for little North Korea. All of that has a bigger game in mind, a bigger fish to fry. That would be called China. Yes. But of course, North Korea is indeed a useful pretext justifying this massive mobilization. I mean, we're talking about hundreds of billions over time, trillions of dollars being spent to do this. John Kiriakou, I think, though, we are completely out of time.
We're out of time, unfortunately. We were joined from Toronto by Chris Black. He is an international criminal lawyer who is on the list of counsel before the International Criminal Court. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We will be right back after this.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Secretary of State Rex Tillerson has signaled his support for a coup in Venezuela, praising the history of military rule in Latin America and calling the armed forces there an agent of change. We're joined in studio by Gloria Lariva. She is the director of the Cuba and Venezuela Solidarity Committee. Gloria, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Gloria, this statement by Rex Tillerson is being reported by the BBC as a joke or something tongue-in-cheek. It sounds to me that it's deadly serious. Calling for or even alluding to the notion of a military coup in a Latin American country is certainly not the way that you want to improve relations. What's behind this statement?
Well, the U.S. believes that only they can carry out coups in Latin America. I think it's wishful thinking on Tillerson's part and the U.S. State Department. But it is dangerous because all the U.S. needs at this point of international relations is an incident to justify further military or political economic action. There have been two incidents recently of individuals carrying out really adventuristic attacks, and they failed. But also, these must be planned with the approval of the United States. However, I think that the announcement by Tillerson is indicative of real concern by the U.S. government that the Venezuelan government is resolving economic crisis and other political situations like the violence that's been going on for years that has really quelled since last year. And the U.S. worries that it's losing any possible option for overthrowing the government. And that's why his announcement.
One thing I think all Americans should try to remember is that before becoming Secretary of State, Rex Tillerson was the CEO of ExxonMobil. Do you think, I don't mean to be conspiratorial, but do you think that the notion of oil is behind this statement?
Absolutely. Venezuela has the largest reserves by far in the world of oil, as well as natural gas and other minerals. But the question of oil, under Chavez's presidency, Exxon was really, and the other oil companies, foreign oil companies, were dealt a heavy blow by a very large taxation on their profits. And Exxon was basically expelled in recent years. And on the other hand, there's a major dispute between Guyana and Venezuela in which ExxonMobil is backing Guyana because it has discovered enormous oil deposits in the waters off Guyana and in a region that borders Guyana called the Essequibo in Venezuela. Venezuela claims the land and Guyana claims the land. So the U.S. government has been militarily and politically bolstering Guyana in the last 3 years since the discovery or announcement of that oil. And of course, with Tillerson being a former CEO of oil, and of course, backing the U.S. government's desire to control oil reserves in the world, this is the main reason, I think, behind the announcement.
So we have Rex Tillerson, now Secretary of State, formerly the CEO of ExxonMobil. And of course, as Gloria LaRiva is mentioning, ExxonMobil lost big as a consequence of the policies of the Bolivarian Revolution, where Hugo Chavez attempted to use oil revenues, and there's vast oil revenues. It's perhaps 95% of Venezuela's national budget for poor people and people who were, you know, living in dire poverty. Their social circumstances have improved substantially, even with all of the economic turmoil. And there is a great deal of economic turmoil and dislocation right now for the very, very poor, and perhaps they are the big majority in Venezuela. Life got better. And as a consequence, Gloria, you said in the last year, the opposition that's been backed by the United States has in some ways weakened. It's been fragmented. It lost out a big time with the election of the Constituent Assembly back in the summer. That doesn't mean Venezuela's economic problems are over. Far from it. I mean, there's staggering economic problems and issues that the government has to cope with. But let's talk about what Tillerson is suggesting about a military solution, a military dictatorship. And we know you go to Brazil or El Salvador, or Nicaragua, the U.S. Was training the militaries of Latin America and conducting coup d'etats and overthrows of democratically elected governments if those governments adopted populist programs. What's the status of the Venezuelan military? Is it possible that it would be the agency for a coup d'etat against Nicolas Maduro?
Well, as I said, you know, assassinations can take place with a very carefully planned individual or small group of people. That is possible. I would regard that as a more of a likelihood. I regard as a more of a likelihood that the U.S. would attempt than a coup, an overthrow by the military. Remember that when the military tried to overthrow Chavez in 2002, the top officers involved in that plot were purged, and we've seen more than a generation now of youth who've joined the military on a pro-socialist basis. So I think that a coup is highly unlikely, but it's still a dangerous call to the right-wing governments in Latin America. Remember that Tillerson right now is visiting five pro-U.S. governments, Mexico, Peru, Colombia, Argentina, and Jamaica in the Caribbean.
Yeah, but again, politically, since, I mean, the Bolivarian Revolution is almost 20 years old. Is the military the old military, or has it transformed as a consequence of purges or reforms? In other words, do you believe that the officer corps in Venezuela is loyal to the socialist government, or does it resemble the old Latin American militaries that were, in fact, an extension of American power?
Oh, I think it's a new military. It's not. It doesn't follow the pattern of a classic overthrow of an old state in social revolutions. But in fact, the Chavez being military, Vladimir Padrino being the head of the military, who's quite loyal to the Chavista program, to Maduro, and to the revolution, as well as people, other leaders like Diosdado Cabello, who came from the military. And even though Maduro is not from the military, I do believe that the military is pro-revolution.
I have to read a quote, and I'd like for you to tell me who said this. And this is the quote: "Latin America does not need new imperial powers that seek only to benefit their own people."
I think that was the strangest quotation, and that, I know it's from Rex Tillerson.
That is our Secretary of State, Rex Tillerson, not talking about American imperialism in Latin America, but talking about Chinese economic relations with Venezuela. He also warned of Russia. It says here in the BBC report, he accused Russia of selling weapons to authoritarian regimes and described its increasing influence in the region as alarming.
I think the Chinese have translated the Monroe Doctrine into Mandarin, and from now on, it will be China's backyard. I mean, of course, this is so ludicrous.
Ridiculous.
Yeah, only the U.S. can be the empire, but as you said, Brian, he's evoking the Monroe Doctrine.
Yeah, and here, I mean, that's the sad truth, that since 1815, the United States has laid claim on the entire Western Hemisphere, and in particular on Latin America, and all parts of North America, including Mexico. We have a showdown going on. We have, and you can see it, Gloria, there's been a number of the formerly left-wing governments have been replaced by very right-wing governments, by neoliberal governments. And of course, the United States feels perhaps it's on a roll, and Venezuela would be the next in line. You just came back from Cuba. There's a long-standing relationship between Cuba and Venezuela during these last 20 years. Big, big help for Cuba to have Venezuela, a major oil producer, but a big help for Venezuela to have a country like Cuba, which had gone through a revolutionary process and also had healthcare professionals and other kind of social assets that were able to be brought to bear in Venezuela. So what's your prediction? I mean, we have about 2 minutes left. Where's it all going?
The solidarity between Venezuela and Cuba is solid. I think they affirm their relationship all the time. The foreign minister, Jorge Arreaza, right now is in Cuba. I think in terms of Latin America, it is a very dangerous time that we're in. But I want to say this was announced, this strategy of the U.S. in turning back the progress that was taking place in the 2000s was really a policy of Barack Obama. He made that speech saying as much. In May 2008, when he was running for president, it was like Bush was ineffective. I will be the effective president. And we will not let Hugo Chavez continue his checkbook diplomacy in Latin America. That's what Obama said. So we're seeing the results of that. His first act was Hillary Clinton, the coup in Honduras. But we're seeing struggle in Latin America of a resistance to the U.S. attempt to take back dominating control of Latin America. The marches, the protests against the inauguration in Honduras of this fraudulent president. And the workers in Argentina are planning a massive general strike this month. I mean, there's a lot taking place going on. And there is a coming election this year in Mexico. The U.S. will certainly try to intervene in that.
We have also, in the case of Brazil, the Dilma Rousseff Workers' Party was ousted in a legislative coup d'etat. Now you have Lula, the most important or most popular politician in Brazil and the leader, founder of the Workers' Party. He's been sentenced to 9.5 years in prison, really to prevent him from running or winning or taking office in Brazil in the next presidential election next year. You're right. I mean, there is this new polarization or the repolarization of Latin America, new right-wing governments coming into being, but the progressive forces, while they've lost office, are now active again as a grassroots opposition, as a street-based opposition. And you're seeing that now all across Brazil as well. So these are going to be, in the next few years, sort of a new showdown, I would say. And of course, we know where the U.S. government will land, John Kiriakou. I mean, Rex Tillerson's comments, while odious, not accidental, given the track record here of the U.S.
And not really a change in long-term U.S. foreign policy toward Venezuela and greater Latin America. It's the sad truth.
And the U.S. attempt through using the Organization of American States, these right-wing governments in Latin America, have really failed in trying to bring regime change in Venezuela. So I think that perhaps the U.S. role will attempt to become more direct. I think the people are backing Maduro. The elections are coming up in April.
Yeah, and Trump said all options are on the table, so maybe, I mean, it seems like madness, but who knows?
Again, it's another issue that we're going to have to revisit. We were joined in studio by Gloria Lariva. She is the director of the Cuba and Venezuela Solidarity Committee. You've been listening to Loud and Clear. We are out of time. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. You can also hear us every day, Monday through Friday, from 4 to 6 p.m. on 105.5 FM and 1390 AM in the Washington, D.C. area. You can also hear us at SputnikNews.com and as a podcast at iTunes. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. We'll see you next time.
Loud and Clear.